it's so nice to meet you. Thank you,
you too.
So much. I'm very, very hyped to be talking to you. I am obsessed with Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. I didn't get the name wrong, did I?
No, you got it perfect.
Good. I was like, I just sort of said it and then I thought, oh, no, wait.
Oh, you know what? No, the UK subtitle is different. It's Coming of Age in Diet Culture. Mm-hmm. I should know the titles of my own books.
That's interesting. Coming of Age in Diet Culture rather than Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture. Very intriguing. Maybe we can discuss that further in this chat about what that distinction. Mm-hmm. So I've read it and I'm obsessed with it. And I think I keep trying to talk to people about it, but obviously they haven't read it. Because it's only just out now in the UK when this episode goes live. Could you just kick us off by describing what this book is? Just in a nutshell, you will do it better than I will.
Sure. So Fat Talk is a book for parents, but really anyone who is involved in children's lives or has a body themselves. So I think that's where some of the subtitle debate has come from, is how much this is a parenting book or not. But it's really a book for all of us to help us understand what anti-fat bias is and why that has come to underpin everything we think about our bodies, about health, about food, exercise, and particularly everything we think about kids' bodies and how kids' bodies should be growing, how they should be moving and eating. Because, you know, so the backstory on the book is I'd written my first book was called The Eating Instinct, Food Culture, Body Image, and Guilt in America. And it's a like fairly nuanced exploration of the rise of modern diet culture and how it shows up in these ways that we relate to food that you wouldn't think would be about dieting, like how you feed a baby or, you know, families that are very food insecure and are worrying about having enough to eat, but also worrying about being thin. And so that was a pretty like nuanced look at the relationship with food. But once that book came out and I started talking to folks, I would hear questions in particular from parents, but really from everyone over and over again, saying something like, you know, well, I want to love my body, or I want my child to love their body. I want them to not be stressed about food the way I am, but I also don't want them to be fat. And I just realized we are never going to achieve the first goal if we still have contingencies over which bodies get to love themselves, which bodies get to have food freedom. And so it really has to start with understanding anti-fatness and how it shows up.
We will return to many things in that. So I've already written down loads of notes about things I want to ask you about, but many of which you have already alluded to in that intro. But I'd really love for you to talk a bit more about your background, like what we know you have already written another book, but what had led up to the creation of this particular book? What is your work background and life experience that got you to this point?
Well, I'm a person with a body. That's some lived experience that we all share. But I am a journalist. I started in women's magazines. So here in the US, magazines like Glamour and Shape and Fitness and Marie Claire, all those sort of glossy titles. I worked in that space for around 10 years, very much creating diet culture, writing a lot of, you know, stories that weren't like just starve yourself kind of weight loss stories, but the sort of it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle plan kind of weight loss story where, you know, this is like a gentler, easier way to do it. I did that for about a decade and really struggled with it, really felt like we weren't doing the responsible thing. I could see it was not making readers happier. You know, we wouldn't be deluged every month with letters from readers asking how to do this if it could work. So obviously we weren't telling people anything useful. But I was still in the very much in diet culture myself, experimenting with dieting, trying to come to terms with the fact that I was a thin kid I identify as a small fat adult. And that transition was very confusing for me because I had been told that my thinness was like a superpower, you know, that it was this innate thing in me that I was responsible for maintaining and that it was somehow as much a part of my identity as being a writer or being funny or liking gardening, you know, these other sort of personality traits. I felt like thinness was one of those things that I had to hang on to. And so to understand that I wasn't going to be thin as an adult felt like this huge failure. And so I was working through all of that. And then I became a mom in 2013, and we had a pretty intense experience with our first daughter's health. She was born with a heart condition, and actually was dependent on a feeding tube for the first 2 years of her life as sort of a response to all that early medical trauma. And so that's actually what inspired the eating instinct, because that was the experience where I suddenly realized I had been spending my whole life waiting for someone to tell me how to do eating right, how to do having a body right, like that there was this set of rules I could find to follow and it would all work out and I would be thin, but I wouldn't be stressed about it, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly I'm in this situation with this baby who can't eat and who's dependent on a feeding tube. And I realized, like, there are no rules. There is nobody coming to save us. There's no answers to this one. And it just helped me see that, you know, it helped me see the whole system, because we were suddenly pushed so far outside the system that I was suddenly like, oh, I've been trying to find all these answers everywhere else, but she and I are just going to have to figure this out ourselves. And we have to reject all these standards of what it means to be a healthy eater, a perfect eater, or any of those sorts of labels that we put on kids, but also on ourselves. We have to figure out what this means for us. And so that was my first step into doing this work in a deeper way. And in the decades since then, you know, I wrote the first book and then also started doing a lot of reporting on what diet culture is, how it's created, and how anti-fatness underpins all of that. And that's what really led me to doing Fat Talk.
Hearing about your experience with your first child is very interesting, because I feel like, you know, the expression, like, as long as you're happy and healthy, feels like a really common kind of gate to how we kind of think, you know, or sort of dismiss or talk about or think about like bodies, and in a kind of more personal centric way, like body positivity.
Yeah.
And it feels kind of radical to like let go of health as a kind of universal goal. And, you know, in the, not just in the way that it applies to kind of, you know, your child being born without, you know, that kind of immediate, like, happy and healthy, like, you know, the way that we kind of say it to, like, parents. But also that kind of, you know, almost adult personal responsibility of, like, being happy and healthy. And I really like that it does not, your writing and your thinking does not accept, like, health as a universal thing to aspire to, or that's, you know, a kind of cost of admission to like having a human body. It does feel like weirdly radical.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're bringing this up. This is a really tricky piece of this conversation, but it's super important. I mean, what we have to step back and realize is that health is not a given for anybody. And it's much less something we can choose or we can control than we like to think. And I mean, I think my daughter's experience was what helped me recognize that, but I should have understood this. Like, it shouldn't have taken me having a kid to learn this lesson, but it did. But, you know, to have a baby born with a congenital condition that she did not choose, that was going to dramatically impact certainly the first few years of her life, and is something we, you know, continue to monitor and manage. It just made me understand that, yeah, like hoping for just a healthy baby and all that matters is a healthy baby does such a disservice to anyone who can't achieve, quote, health, because their lives are still valuable. They're still important. They're still contributing to the world. They're still, you know, they're still loved and treasured by the people around them. And so to put so much emphasis on health when so many people cannot choose health and cannot access health is really narrowing, like just really narrowing in on who we consider a valuable human being in a way that's actually really scary when you look at it. And so, yeah, it's true for, you know, someone born with a congenital condition, but it's also true for, you know, low-income folks who can't access healthcare. You all do a better job of that in the UK than we do, but here in the States, health is definitely a privilege of the rich and not something that everyone can access easily. And, you know, if you're marginalized in any other way, and so particularly for fat folks, when they go into doctor's offices, we're likely to be stigmatized against, we're likely to receive lower quality care because doctors judge based on what they see about our bodies. They make assumptions about our lifestyle habits and our commitment to our health. And then that really compromises the health we are able to access in a medical setting. So once you start to think of health as more of a resource that currently we are hoarding, like privileged people are hoarding, instead of something that everyone can sort of freely take part in, you realize that, yeah, this whole emphasis on health, if we really care about health, we would be working on things like reducing childhood hunger and fighting poverty and making, you know, healthcare more accessible globally and making things like paid leave accessible globally. Like, there's so many larger structural changes that we need to make health something everyone can participate in, that to make it all about personal choices and personal responsibility is doing such a disservice to that.
And it also, I feel like something that your book does, which, you know, equally feels very radical, is to not accept the premise that, like, quote unquote, childhood obesity is in itself a problem.
Right.
So I feel like that's such a, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, even when you're talking about fat liberation or whatever in the adult sphere, that's like relatively safe territory. But as soon as you try and kind of bring that into, you know, the world of children, it feels like, you know, as a non-parent, but someone who has in my life been a fat child, it still feels like weirdly kind of like radical ground. Like, have you had any pushback? Like, what kind of pushback have you had on this as like a
This is like the third rail of the whole conversation. I mean, I think fat acceptance and fat liberation only get so far before inevitably somebody says, but what about the children? Surely you don't mean childhood obesity is not a problem. And that gets thrown down as this gauntlet, like you are just not going to be able to cross that line. And so that was sort of the challenge to me in writing the book, was I was like, but hang on, if we're saying that all bodies are valuable, if we're saying that health is a resource and currently not a right, although it should be a right, you know, we have to really change this whole conversation about childhood obesity, because what we're doing right now is pathologizing millions of kids' bodies, assuming they are unhealthy based on their size, assuming so many things about their parents, the quality of parenting they're receiving, about their lifestyle habits, about their intelligence. I mean, the number of studies I found showing how having a high BMI as a kid means you are immediately judged and shamed and a target of bullying. Like, the data is very clear that, yeah, kids in bigger bodies have tougher lives, but it's not because of the size of their body. It's because of the way the world treats them. And so this whole conversation, this whole war on childhood obesity that we've been fighting for 40 years, it was supposed to be about kids' health. It was supposed to be about making kids healthier, but all it has done is create this epidemic of shame and stigma and then disordered eating and eating disorders that come out of those experiences. And so, yeah, again, this is just like, if we really care about health, this is not a useful conversation. Making it about kids' body size only makes them targets. It doesn't make them, you know, it either makes them victims to be pitied or it makes them people to be judged and ridiculed. So that doesn't make anyone healthier.
Yeah, and it feels like one of the, I never remember what the actual expression is, but there's just the, it's something like a conversation stopping thought. Yeah. You know, it's like things that you say like, oh, it's what's best for my family, or it's like blah, 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 you know, and then that's kind of the symbolic end of the conversation. And I feel like stuff around like childhood health is, you know, meant to be that. And it was just so, you know, new and refreshing to read something that didn't treat that as like a given. I am always very, you know, as an author myself, I'm always very nerdily interested in how books are written, but I found myself just so completely fascinated in with this book in particular with how you wrote it. So it's like very, very thorough. Like, that's the word I keep using to describe it. And I know that other people have also used that word, in that, you know, it has an enormous amount of research, but it also has huge amounts of case studies. Mm-hmm. Who are these people and how did you find them? And how did you develop the kind of trust that you would need to have? Like, just some of the honesty from, like, not just the parents, but in particular, the children speaking about their experiences. Like, my sense of like deep shame at being a fat child would never have enabled me to like speak like that, even to someone that I trusted, I think. So I was just very interested to know like about the actual creation of the book in practical terms.
Yeah. I mean, the stories, working with the families on this book has been an experience that, you know, I will continue to think about for the rest of my life. Like, it was such an honor to be able to get to know these families, to tell their stories, to have them be vulnerable with me. It was amazing. And So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'm a journalist. I specialize in narrative nonfiction. So I always approach anything I'm writing about with whose story am I going to use to tell this? And, you know, there's, to be honest, there's something a little manipulative about it. Like you're sort of almost casting a movie in a sense, like, you know, you need that narrative though. But I do fundamentally believe that the research is important. The research is really useful. Everything I just said about childhood obesity and health is like very backed up in the book by study after study. And so if you are someone who needs data to understand these issues, it's there. But I don't think we change hearts and minds with data. I think we change hearts and minds with people's lived experiences. And so telling these family stories, I knew was going to be critical to helping people start to rethink this whole issue, start to understand, oh, wow, I have a bias against fat people, against fat kids that just comes up without me even considering it. But now I'm in this family story and I'm understanding what their life really looks like. And I'm realizing how wrong I was. So that was why that would be so necessary. In terms of how I find folks, it's lots of different ways. And it always, there's always a moment of panic in the reporting where I think like, no one is going to talk to me. No one wants to talk about this. I'm not going to have any sources. This is all falling apart. But somehow, you know, I put call outs on social media. I definitely tap into my own Instagram community and my newsletter, Burnt Toast, that community of readers who know. So there I have some trust already. People know and follow me and would trust me to tell their stories, or they would share the call outs with their communities and say like, this is a journalist I know and trust and she'll do, you know, she'll do your story justice. I would also reach out to eating disorder therapists, doctors, you know, experts in the field who of course, like they can't violate their patient's confidentiality by like handing them over to me, but they might say to a patient they have a good relationship with, you know, if this is something that would be good for you to tell your story, this journalist is looking. And so a few people came in that way. Also a lot of like combing through Facebook groups, like mom groups and eating disorder support groups and posting in there. So it's, you know, you just have to cast a really wide net. And the other piece of it that's hard is I also want the sources to be fairly diverse in terms of age and economic status and race and gender and all of that. So you're kind of always, that's the part where you feel like a little like a casting director where you're kind of thinking like, do I have too many thin white girls? Yep, I got too many thin white girls. We gotta fix that. And so I had like a big spreadsheet for a while of all the different sources that I was talking to. And then when it comes to building trust, I mean, one thing that was really hard about this book compared to my earlier work is I was reporting it during COVID. So it was all Zoom interviews versus in-person reporting, which, you know, previously, like for The Eating Instinct, I like sat in people's houses with them for days and like got to know them that way. And so not being able to do that initially, I was again like, well, this book is screwed. This is not going to happen. But the Zoom thing turned out better than I thought. I mean, one thing that was nice was I was able to cover more geographic diversity because I didn't have to like get on a plane to talk to people. You know, I could set up interviews with people further away. And I also found, especially with the kids, I think because the kids today are digital natives and they're used to being on Snapchat and FaceTime and whatever, they were pretty comfortable with it. And it meant that I was often like in their bedrooms with them or in a place where they were very relaxed. And if I was interviewing a 15-year-old in person, I don't think I would be like, can I come into your bedroom? Like that would feel weird. But because that's like where they happened to be with their phone when I called, you know, it was somehow more fine. And so they would, you know, that would sort of open them up. And I also texted with a lot of them. Like a lot of kids will talk more over text than they will in the Zoom conversation. So we'd like have text follow-ups where I'd get like more details or more, you know, so that was interesting to sort of like see how the technology created that rapport when I thought it was going to be a barrier. And then a lot of it is just, you know, really going slow with the conversations, letting them really set the pace, letting them know that, you know, I did change names of almost all the children in the book. The only exceptions were people who'd like been on record with their story in some other capacity, but, you know, that their privacy was going to be protected. When we were talking about sensitive stuff, I would often check in and say, you know, are you comfortable with me using this? You know, is there a detail or two we need to change to protect you? And just being really open to that conversation. So yeah, there was a lot of moving parts to it, but I'm hoping you know, when someone agrees to be in a book, you can never guarantee they're going to like everything you write. That's not journalism. But I'm hoping that most of them or all of them will feel like they helped contribute to something good and useful in the world.
I would hope so. I also found it was almost uncommonly kind of kind and generous towards pretty much everyone, even people or groups or figures that it would be quite easy to uncritically kind of demonize or scapegoat. And something I found really, really interesting was kind of thinking about like the mom.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know, you know, if you kind of, unfortunately, I find if you talk to most fat women in some way and you say, you know, you ask for their kind of like fat life story, then there will probably be some element yeah. like an older female relation having some kind of, you know.
Absolutely.
But it was just so interesting to read a more kind of, you know, empathetic and nuanced take on that, that, you know, helped me personally kind of, you know, think more generously about that. Did you find that parents were maybe less forthcoming than children or, you know, I don't know. I just, I'm always interested in how people kind of, because, you know, being a parent is such an enormous responsibility. And then to have to think about how you are impacting your child, I don't know. Yeah.
Just, yeah. It depended a lot on whether the parent had been the first person in touch with me or the child. There were a couple of stories in the book where the kids were the ones who had volunteered to do this, and the parent was sort of along for the ride. And I definitely picked up on more hesitancy from those parents, not really being sure what was going to be said about them or how it was going to be framed or, you know, and that's very understandable. And also they're being very protective of their child, right? Because I know how I would feel if a journalist approached my kid and was like, hey, you want to talk to me for this book? You know, like, okay, we're going to have some guardrails around this for sure. So that was when I'd have to do more trust building with the parents. But otherwise I was really amazed at how willing a lot of the moms were to look pretty open-eyed at their track records and their histories and be willing to say, like, I caused harm doing this and I want to do something different. I don't know what I'm supposed to do different, but I can see this isn't working. And even when they were doing pretty, you know, disordered things like putting snacks in lockboxes or really controlling what their kids could wear, you know, things that I think an eating disorder therapist would say to them, like, this is potentially dangerous territory here. You know, they were open with me about it and they were reflecting on it. And not every parent in the book changed and became like a radicalized fat liberationist by any means. But it made me realize, like, yes, I have the same experience you do, which anytime I interview an adult about their relationship with food and body, the mother in particular almost always comes up and can get painted as a villain. I mean, I think we're seeing that with the whole almond mom trend on social media right now. And it's just, it's not that they're not really causing harm. That trauma is so real and people are fully entitled to have all of their feelings about it and name it and call it out for sure. But also these women are victims of the same system. They're struggling. And what most often comes out to me when I talk to parents who have tried to control their child's weight is that they are desperate to protect their child and they are just going about it in the wrong way. They are thinking, I don't want my child to be bullied the way I was. I don't want them to struggle. If they're thin, they'll be safe. And they're not wrong, you know? That's true. Like, that's how the world treats you. So they're identifying that, but what they're doing wrong is saying, I'll control it through my child's body instead of I'll protect my child, I'll support my child navigating this hard thing in the world. And how can we change the world? But I get changing the world feels a lot harder, you know, that doesn't feel available to everyone. So,
well, yeah. And also, you know, it's almost asking for kind of future, I don't know how to explain it, but to sort of believe that you will somehow change the world is like almost delayed gratification. Whereas in the moment you think,
right,
I can control this specific, you know, I can enable my child to lose weight. I can, you know, that's like a tangible thing that I can do. And that must feel in a way more tempting than trust right. that the world is ready for whatever you're going to try and however you're going to try and change it with your child.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit asking parents to let their kids be the social experiment, to say, like, if you didn't try to change your child's body, if we instead work on changing the world, wouldn't this be so much better for your kid and for all kids? Yes, and it will be hard. It will be really hard for your kid sometimes. But I think it is harder for your kid to feel like their body is not safe in your home and to feel like you don't accept their body. So I think this is the greater good, but I can definitely understand in the moment, in that terror, feeling like, no, no, that's too hard. That's too scary. I'm going to work on, you know, getting all the carbs out of our house. That's what I'm going to do.
Because the word that comes up a lot in Fat Talk in relation to children and their bodies is autonomy. And I feel like that, would you say that that is maybe the key message of the book, is trying to create a relationship between you and your child and food, where they feel autonomous?
Yes. Body autonomy is what we're going for. I think it's a much more useful concept than body positivity or even body neutrality. I think too, it helps as sort of a through line. Like, you know, it's so tempting, no matter what your kid's body size is, there's so much pressure on how we feed our kids that parents can get really caught up in all the details of it. And are they eating vegetables? And how hard should I push them to eat vegetables? And how hard should I push them not to have too many sweets or whatever, you know? And if you're instead like, oh, wait, my big picture goal is body autonomy. It's not nutrition. It's not eating perfectly. It's body autonomy. I want my kid to walk away from family meals feeling like I trusted them to make decisions about their body. That really lets you let go a lot of those power struggles that are just maddening as a parent to deal with. So it just takes a lot of pressure off. And I think it is the more important foundation. I think kids have their whole lives to learn to like vegetables or not, but we only have so many years to help them understand that they can trust their bodies first. And, you know, by the time you get to the teenage years and kids are encountering stuff like drugs and alcohol and sex and, you know, risk-taking of all kinds, I want that body autonomy foundation in place. I want them knowing they can say no to something and their no should be respected. And if that means we have to practice that at dinner because I made chicken last night and one child said a very definitive no and, you know, was not polite about it, like, okay, but that's in service of a greater good of, you know, of her being able to say no when she needs to.
And that was a part of the book that I found really interesting as well, was, you know, essentially that most children, no matter what they eat, if they are eating enough, are not going to be in any significant way kind of malnourished or deficient in the vitamins. And that was not really something that I had thought about, because obviously, you know, we get all these messages about, you know, 5 a day or 7 a day. I don't know. Apparently it's gone up.
I know. It's always going up.
It's always going up at great financial cost.
Yes. Which
we all seem to talk about.
Yes.
So yeah, just take it. I feel like what I found quite exciting about the book was that it took all these things that we take for granted as being quite neutral truths and made you actually question them. So things like, you know, childhood nutrition, vitamins and minerals, and, you know, it's important to make your child eat everything that you are feeding them, because what if they are malnourished? And it's like, the odds are, like, if you are a relative, you know, an even relatively like well-off family, you're probably feeding your child enough food, and that food will probably sustain them through all of the tasks that they need to do. I'd found that like a very, you know, weirdly radical thought.
Yeah, it's really liberating. I mean, it's something I have to come back to a lot. I have two pretty cautious eaters. So there are weeks where I'm like, I think they're surviving on carpet lint. Like, I'm not really sure what they're eating. But I'm trusting them. And yes, I know that because we have financial security, because we are not, you know, so if you are a family that struggles to have enough food to eat, period, that's a whole different thing. And you need a whole different set of supports. But if you are not food insecure, you are able to afford enough food for everyone in your family to eat what they need, the nutrition will work itself out. And you see kids, when we're not putting all that pressure on them, you see them do this really pretty effortlessly. Like last night, one of the children who hasn't touched chicken in years was like, oh, I will eat an entire chicken thigh. Like, this is amazing. And I thought, like, oh, that's so interesting. And I thought over the last few days, I was like, yeah, she hasn't had a lot of protein. Like, probably her body kind of was like, yep, time for some protein, you know? And then the other one was like mostly eating watermelon for dinner. But okay, you know, maybe she hadn't had a lot of fruit in the last couple of days. So it's just interesting to watch them when there's not this sort of laser focus on how much are you eating and are you eating good foods or bad foods? And, you know, is there a rainbow on your plate? You can watch them sort of sort it out for themselves and trust that they will get what they need, that, you know, and even if your kids are not touching a lot of protein and a lot of vegetables, those are the two foods that parents always feel like their kids need more of. You know, fruit has most of the same nutrients as vegetables. Even the boxed carbohydrates that people love to demonize are fortified with vitamins and minerals that they need and have more protein than you think. So yeah, all these little details of nutrition really do sort themselves out as long as kids can get enough to eat. So yeah.
The other kind of thing that we very much accept as true, which has been slightly spoiled by our good friends on Maintenance Phase, who just did the sugar episode where they referred to your book. That was one of the massive like plot twists that I took away from Fat Talk, was about the fact that, you know, the way that we attribute childhood behavior/hyperactivity
yes.
sugar consumption is just a complete, like, almost entirely a myth. And yeah. I just never, yeah, another thing where you just take it for granted that it's true because it was said to you as a child, and then, you know, it's still being said, and it's just one of those kind of like repeated truths. I just feel like the book is just full of all of these things that you're like, oh, well, it must be true because it feels true. And then it's actually, you know, and again, I read this book at the beginning of the year called Food Is Not Medicine by Dr. Joshua Warich. And he just kept saying, like, you are not a rat. Like, you know,
yes.
things that have been tested on rats, that's not necessarily true for humans. Like, you are not a rodent. Like, you are a person. And it felt kind of, you know, with this book that I think when we think about like food and eating and bodies, and you have to remember that like people are also people. And so there's always the like psychological element. Like we're not just rats. We're also, you know, people who do things and have feelings. And it felt like very kind of radically empathetic in that way. So speaking of Maintenance Phase, as I just did, do you feel like we are in a moment where like things are getting better or at least more critical, or do you think it's getting worse, or like what's the Virginia Solsmith bird's eye view of the kind of food and body landscape?
I think we're in a very messy middle place. I think things are getting better, and that means the backlash is intensifying. That's something, you know, Aubrey and I have talked about as well, like, since we both do this work in a somewhat public-facing way, we get the hate mail and we get the positive. And so you're sort of always like, which pile of emails is bigger today? I don't know. But I think you really see the fact that this book is happening, you know, that Maintenance Phase is as popular as it is, that, you know, mainstream media outlets are doing articles on anti-fat bias. I can tell you as a journalist who's been trying to cover this topic for, you know, the better part of 10, 15 years, like that was not true a decade ago. I was having to explain to editors what, you know, intuitive eating was or what diet culture was. And they were extremely skeptical, extremely hesitant to really give this conversation any kind of platform. And I think this is one of the gifts of social media. Obviously, there's a lot of negatives too, but one of the gifts is that we were able to start to center these conversations and center fat activists who were not part of the mainstream discussion and elevate this discourse. So that's been really good. But then on the flip side, you see things like Ozempic, you see things like in the States, we just had the American Academy of Pediatrics roll out this clinical guideline stuff about putting kids on diets and weight loss drugs at pretty young ages. And so you see the attempt to hold on to the status quo and people really digging in. And I think that's understandable that the fight is getting harder because it means we're making some progress. So I think it's like weirdly good, but also, yeah, now we really have to keep going because the stakes are intensifying.
Mm. Maybe we can return to talking about Ozempic in the fullness of time, but I just wanted to ask, your last book came out in was it The Eating Instinct in 2018?
Yes, that's right.
In what kind of ways do you think things have changed between the publication of the two books?
Oh, I think there's been a really big change. I mean, even for myself, I will always love The Eating Instinct. I'm very proud of it as my first book. But, you know, I was using obesity without much reflection on what a derogatory term that was. I think the conversation about language has really evolved. And now we understand that obesity and overweight are pretty stigmatizing terms and that a lot of us would rather just say fat and reclaim fat as a neutral term. Again, that conversation was happening 5 years ago, but I think it's mainstreamed a little more. I think that certainly, I mean, maintenance phase is a great example. That was around 5 years ago. There's, you know, just more elevating of these conversations in different ways. You know, the piece with the eating instinct has quite a lot of dissection of diet culture and sort of the beginnings of this work on anti-fatness in it. But the pieces of that book that everyone wanted to talk about were, what do I do about having a picky eater? And my personal story about having a daughter with a medical feeding issue. And I get why people gravitated to those stories, but I would always kind of be like, but there's this whole other, we've got to talk about this other stuff, like this other conversation we're kind of skipping here, guys. And stuff like social determinants of health, understanding like weight stigma as a form of oppression. All of that was like a much more uphill battle for me to get that conversation out there. And now that's like my starting point with this work. And I think, you know, it really, of course, depends on like which media outlet I'm talking to. Obviously, you and I are deep in this work and we're talking about it in a pretty nitty gritty way. When I do a piece for the New York Times or, you know, a like general radio interview, I'm having to say like, yes, really, it's okay to say fat. Like, yes, you know, so people are in all different places with this, but I am just feeling like there's a lot more out there for folks to grab onto. There's many more books in this space, like, you know, many more books by fat authors coming out, which is really exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Right at the beginning, when you were talking about your previous journalistic experience with women's magazines, you were talking about kind of your complicity or whatever in stories that are not just kind of like starve yourself, that, you know, this is like a gentler, easier way to do mm-hmm. diet. And it does feel like, you know, as much as there is now a kind of pushback against that, there is still this kind of, you know, repackaging and like Weight Watchers is now WW and, you know, things like strong is the new skinny, but yet you really see women who are already thin kind of saying that. It just feels like there's this kind of like real muddying of the waters around bodies, because obviously we've all got a body, and most people, especially most women, to some degree have negative feelings about their body. And that gets very much kind of conflated with like anti-fatness as a kind of social justice issue. Mm-hmm. It just felt kind of like a relief to read something that both at the same time kind of said, yes, it is hard for everyone to have a body, but also there are these specific and tangible ways that like anti-fatness operates. And these are maybe some ways that we can like think in solidarity with, you know, bring those two things together. I don't know. I'm just thinking about like, you know, the video you made about like the term midsize and,
Midsize queen.
I don't know, like it's almost like there's this kind of desire to sort of say yes, but I am oppressed because I have a body, but not actually really wanting to think about like the harm that you perpetrate against people who are bigger than you.
I think we're really uncomfortable with the idea of thin privilege, you know, the idea that this is a spectrum of bias, and so it is just hard for everybody to have a body. We all have our own personal stuff with this, and that is real, and you deserve support for it. And your personal struggle is still, you know, can be put on this spectrum compared to someone who may have their personal struggle or not, and also faces all of these biases that limit their ability to move through the world. Like, you might be really struggling with how you feel about your body. Your mom may have said terrible things to you. You may have been on diets from the age of 9, but you are a size 8 and you can walk into any store and find clothes that fit you. And you never have to worry about finding clothes that fit when you need to go to a job interview or, you know, be dressed professionally or anything like that. you know that if you see a doctor, they will not automatically prescribe weight loss for anything you tell them that's wrong, even if it's like a sinus infection, you know, that they will not just immediately assume your body needs to be fixed. You can fit into airplane seats, you can fit into restaurant chairs, you can just move safely through the world and not worry about the level of abuse and scrutiny that fat people have to deal with. And I'm not sure why it is so hard for a lot of thin folks to grasp that. I think it is because it's hard to look at how we've perpetrated it. You know, it's hard to say like, oh, right, I have all this privilege. And that means when I complained to my fat friend about hating my thighs, I was actually really hurting that person, you know, because I was saying to them, like, the worst thing I can imagine is to look like you. And we're really uncomfortable with that. We don't want to acknowledge how we've caused that kind of harm. So it is really tricky to look at, but I think there's such a benefit to it because this also shouldn't be fat people pitted against thin people, right? Like this shouldn't be us versus them or sort of choosing sides. This should be all of us against a system that has been terrible for all of us. And then we can just say like, it's been terrible for all of us, but it's more terrible for the more marginalized people. Like that seems fairly straightforward. But I think it's also scary for folks to think about then, well, how do I use my privilege? How do I be a better ally? Because it would require a lot of us to give up some privilege to actually equalize the system. It would require a lot of us. There's a lot of ways in which I think we know we benefit from whatever degree of thin privilege we have. And to be willing to say, I'm going to put some of that down. I don't need that much. I'll get less benefit from this. My body can be less rewarded so that we can neutralize this for all bodies. I think feels, you know, scary, especially for women who, you know, we're all just surviving under patriarchy and white supremacy in these ways. And it's, you know, it's hard to give up any little toehold you feel like you have.
Yeah. While I have no interest in kind of scaremongering around, you know, Ozempic for fat people who are probably already semi-stressed by it, I am just interested in like your take on, I guess, like where, you know, if you have any info or intel on like where it's kind of headed. Like, do you think there is a chance that it would be approved for children?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, Wegovy, which is a really similar medication, I think it's just a different brand or a different formulation of, it's a sister drug to Ozempic for sure. In the United States is already approved for use in kids as young as 12. And that's what led the American Academy of Pediatrics to issue the new guidelines recommending weight loss drugs for kids as young as 12. So yeah, we are definitely on a path towards weight loss drugs for kids. They will keep adding to that list. I mean, there are other drugs that are already approved for like 13 and up or 15 and up. And they'll keep finding ways to drop those numbers younger. I'm absolutely sure of it. Yeah, I think what's so dark about Ozempic, and I also want to say, you know, if you are a diabetic who needs this medication to manage your diabetes, you should have full access to it. It should be free for you. You should not be worrying about supply issues because so many thin people went to get it to lose 10 pounds, which is what's happening right now. And if you're a fat person who's being pressured to take it or feeling like this is something you need to do, like that is your own personal stuff. And I am not here to judge that at all. But what fundamentally scares me about it is that because the efficacy of it, I mean, to be honest, as we're now getting into the data, it doesn't look like it's going to be the silver bullet they thought. Not shocking. None of the drugs ever are. But because it does seem to produce this dramatic weight loss initially, and because the narrative around it is that it can do that without making you miserable, that, oh, I just don't feel hungry anymore. I suddenly just don't think about food as much. That sounds so appealing to people because that's the thing I was always trying to find in those articles back when I was a women's magazine editor, was what is the diet that won't make us miserable but will make us thin? That's what everybody wants, right? But what's dangerous about wanting that is that what you're really saying is if getting thin is possible and pleasant, like if it's not going to make me miserable and disordered to do it, then it's okay for me to hate fat people and it's okay for me to hate fatness because now we can just achieve thinness. And that is, I mean, it's eugenics. Like that is really scary to say that this whole class of people could just stop existing if we find the thing that makes them stop existing. So that is really the like sort of dark, you know, underbelly of this whole conversation. And, you know, for starters, it's never going to be accessible to everyone. These are really expensive medications. So you're going to see a sort of stratification of, you know, the elite being able to afford a medication that's $900 a month or whatever, and that you have to stay on for the rest of your life and getting thinner, and then lower income folks not having access to it. You're also going to see, you know, just like the idea that it's just undercutting everything we've said, everything I'm trying to say that we should say to our kids about your body is not your value, you know, your body is valuable. This is now gives doctors and parents and everyone a tool to say, well, we can just manipulate it this way and that's fine. And it doesn't matter that it's expensive. It doesn't matter that there's side effects. It doesn't matter that it actually isn't going to work. This is still something you should do.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
I always, since thinking, you know, since the kind of rise of Ozempic over the last few months, I keep bringing up, have you read the short story called The Pill by Meg Ellison?
I don't think I have.
I read it like last summer, and it's literally a short story that imagines a world where there is a pill that you can take that will make you thin overnight. There is like some chance of death attached to it, but almost everybody takes it anyway. And then that kind of in itself has created this like even more kind of marginalized taboo class of fat people who refuse.
Yes.
And that's what I have been really like. That's yes. The thing. Ever since I read that, I was like, wow, yeah, what a weird thought experiment. And then
understand. Then it happened.
And it literally happened within like a year and has happened in such a like huge way. Yes. But it is, you know, and I don't, you know, as I said, I don't want to like scaremonger around it. I don't think that helps anyone. But, you know, just having to think through like, you know, what would life be like to be one of the lone holdouts in a world that, you know, has developed this thing that could make you thin.
Yeah.
So every time there's more and more evidence that it is like, not a silver bullet, not a miracle drug, I'm like, cool. So I will still be allowed to, you know, to just be, you know, fat in some way for the rest of my life, which is, you know, always my intention.
Same.
Yeah. It's just like a weird thing to have to think about, you know,
it's very like sci-fi. How are we here? It's a very, how are we here moment. And again, especially as we were saying, there has been all this progress. But I think it does show, it's a little bit of a litmus test, I think, for folks on like, how much did you believe in this progress or how much were you sort of hiding over here? But now if you don't have to be here, you're not going to be here. And that's, it's a tough question.
So speaking of tough questions, before I kind of, you know, I know we could literally talk for a very long time, but I will not take up too much of your time. Something I was really interested in as a non-parent, you are a parent who spends a lot of their time thinking about this stuff around feeding children and your, you know, the autonomy of children in general. Do you find that even you, the great thinker and proponent and writer of all of this stuff, do you often come up against like challenging situations with your own family dynamic around food? This is just a thing that like, no matter how hard you work at it, you should always expect for it to be this kind of like weirdly fraught.
I think unfortunately, yes. I mean, there's a lot I've let go of and it's really liberating. You know, when I was first, a story I tell in The Eating Instinct is how, you know, when my older daughter was finally starting to eat some food by mouth, she wouldn't drink out of a cup. And so we were still having to use the feeding tube to hydrate her. And it was because water didn't taste like anything. And so she kind of didn't know what to do with it. I mean, she was like a year and a half, 2 years old. And so one of the feeding therapists was like, let's try chocolate milk. And at that point where I was in my diet culture, I was like, I can't give my baby chocolate milk. Oh my gosh, that's so terrible. And then I finally got over it and she like immediately learned how to drink out of a cup because chocolate milk's delicious. And of course she did, you know? And so that's a story I tell to show like how often the sort of quote healthy choice is not the healthy choice. Like everyone says, don't give your children flavored milk, but or juice, but it was incredibly useful in that scenario and great for her. So I've let go a lot of that. I've let go a lot of the like good food, but all of that's gone. Like my house is full of snack foods and processed foods and things that would make lots of diet culture gurus, you know, want to call child services on me. And it's great because it makes feeding them easier. It makes them able to nourish themselves. It's really good. But it is still true that no matter what way you're doing it, feeding kids is so much work. They have to eat all the time, every day. It's just amazing. Like, I get up again and have to make them breakfast. It's just like this never ending work. It's like laundry, but with more moral judgment involved. And so because the labor of it is so much, and because we don't really make that labor more doable or visible, and because women disproportionately do all of that labor, you are always going to have those meals where you think, I work so hard to do this and everyone hates it. And why is this so hard? And, you know, and all I can do, think to do to navigate those moments is just lean into whatever shortcuts makes my life easier. So this week we're eating a lot of takeout because I've got a busy book promotion schedule and I don't need to be like ending long work days and thinking, how am I going to feed everybody? You know, so we're getting pizza. Great. But obviously that's a privilege that we can afford takeout. So it looks different for everybody how you can make your life easier. But I do think it helps to remember this goal of body autonomy. And also to know, this is another piece of research I unpack in the book, all the pressure on us to have family dinner means so much. What our kids really need is connection with us. They really need time with us. It doesn't need to be a home-cooked meal. It doesn't even need to be dinner. They just need time in the day to connect with us. And so if it serves your family best right now to have that happen, not in a food context, to have the kids eat separately, to have dinner be on the go in the car, you can let yourself off that hook and just say, you know what? I connect with my kids by talking to them, by loving them, by reading bedtime stories, whatever you do. And that's good enough. We're all doing good enough. So yeah, that's really what it comes down to. But no, there's definitely weeks where I absolutely despair of how hard it is to come up with meals that four human beings all want to eat. It's absurd. It's absurd. So yeah.
It is absurd. So two final questions. One, is there a book you've read recently that you have found interesting or exciting or inspiring, maybe in this area, maybe not, that you would just like to tell us about? And then secondly, is there an item of clothing that you have acquired recently that you are excited about? Because I know we spoke before.
Yes.
You said you know, nobody asks you about clothes and you love clothes. So I, as someone who also loves clothes, would like to ask you about clothes.
I love your clothes. Your Instagram is a great source of inspiration. Okay, books and clothes. Let me think of some good ones. For books, I'm going to shout out a friend of mine whose book is actually out right around the same time. And we've been kind of hand-holding each other through the book launch process because it's, as you know, an emotional roller coaster. And that is Sarah Louise Peterson, her book Momfluenced, which is a deep dive into mom influencer culture on Instagram. But it's also like kind of motherhood memoir. It's funny. It's personal. She gets into sort of all the intersecting forces that makes performing motherhood such a complicated thing for so many of us. And it's just like deeply relatable and really well-researched. So Momfluenced, super great. Item of clothing that I am excited about. What do I want to say? There's so many choices. But you know,
I'm personally slightly sad. You know, I love your new glasses. But I loved like your old glasses with the turquoise bottoms.
Oh, they're not gone. I was wearing them yesterday.
They're just in rotation. They're not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was worried because when I saw you got new glasses, I was like, but what about the turquoise ones? Because they are like the coolest glasses that I have seen.
No, they are. I literally was wearing them yesterday. I often wear them with this turtleneck because of the turquoise, but I was like, oh, let me mix it up. No, glasses are kind of my thing. My second pregnancy destroyed my ability to wear contact lenses. One of the harsh truths of motherhood we don't talk enough about is dry eyes. And so I was like, I'm going to lean all in on glasses. And I have like too many pairs. It's a thing. And I rotate through all of them. I really like brightly colored glasses. So that is a big one. I'm also going to shout out the brand Girlfriend Collective. I don't know if you've them in the UK.
Today. Yeah, I only wear Girlfriend Collective to work out. I don't wear any other brands. I only wear Girlfriend Collective.
They're the best. So I tell you, I love them so much. I don't work out in them. I wear them. for regular clothes, I like don't want to get them sweaty because I'm so attached to my girlfriend collective, which obviously means I just need more leggings so I can like designate some of the workout pairs. But yeah, I mean, the size, so size inclusive, really good quality, so comfortable. They do not roll down, which is such a problem with leggings. I have a lot of the cute matching bras too. So you can do like the set thing. Yeah. And I have a set in their wild iris color that I'm just like obsessed with. So yeah, let's give my joy.
My sneaky favorite girlfriend collective item is, do you have one of their unitards?
No, I've been, talk to me about the unitard because I've been like, do I need this or will I never be able to pee in it? I just don't understand.
You will never be able to pee in it. That you want to pee, you will have to like fully roll it down.
Yeah.
But I just love it. Like, I feel really cute in it. Like sometimes, like the other day, I wore it all day with like a little shirt or a jumper over it. And then I went to like a bar class or a spin class and I just took the jumper off and I had all of, you know, everything I needed.
You were ready to go.
I was ready to go. I just find it so useful. And I have it in black, which obviously a useful color. Whereas most of my girlfriend collector stuff, I buy like the jankiest color because it's like cheap and used. So I have like a lot of like what can be best described as like Simpsons yellow leggings.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember when they were yellow.
But yeah, love it. Love girlfriend.
That you're selling me on the unitard. I've been contemplating it.
One cheeky. See how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll wait for a good sale on it. That's a great tip.
That's what I did. Yeah. Well, Virginia, thank you so, so, so much for your time. It has been delightful. I'm loved asking you all of my questions. I'm sure I'll think of loads more that I will never get to ask. Your book, Fat Talk, what is the UK title?
Coming of Age and Diet Culture.
Fat Talk, Coming of Age and Diet Culture is out right now. As you can tell, I'm obsessed with it. Cannot recommend it enough. As well, you know, I'm not a parent, but I am a human with a body and I got so much out of it. And I think anyone who listens to What Page Are You On would get a huge amount out of it too. So thank you so much for joining me and hopefully we'll get to speak again one day.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bethany. This was amazing. It really was.
Yeah. Cool. I assume Nikki will send this to me. Was that okay for you?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Oh my gosh, it was amazing. Thank you.
I enjoyed it. Well, I guess I will leave you to go about your day. And yeah, I will see you on the internet, the place where
I live. Absolutely. I'll be there. Thanks so much. Have a good rest of your day. Take care. Bye.